Hello, fellow rebel capitalists. I hope you are well. We are live right now with my good buddy, Brent Johnson. We're going to talk about the dollar, might talk about Evergrande, might talk about China. But we're really going to help educate you, not only to our views, but also how kind of this global monetary system works. And we're going to do all of that in about 10 minutes. Ready to rock and roll, Brent?
Yeah, let's do it.
Shouldn't be too hard of a task. So the first thing I want to do is go over this chart of the DXY. Oh, I just want to point out to the audience that the dollar on the DXY, now this is a chart of a, this is basically a measurement of the dollar against a basket of other currencies, most notably the euro, if I'm not mistaken, is 57% of the DXY.
That's right.
So I just wanted to point out that the dollar has really been going straight up since, call it, June. So Brent, we talked about this briefly when we were in New Orleans on how this might be a result of China slowing down their economy because it's 30% real estate. We see Fantasia, we see Evergrande really having problems. And if so, they're importing fewer goods. Well, if they're importing fewer goods, those transactions or a lot of them would be denominated in dollars. So that means fewer or less dollars getting outside of China circulating in the dollar or the global economy, and maybe better said, there's less dollar-denominated cash flow that's out there that's able to service the dollar-denominated debt. So yeah. Do you think that's contributing to this rise that we're seeing in the DXY, or do you think it's something like what, you know, Schiff talks about all the time, that the market just expects the Fed to raise rates, and therefore that's what's creating this strength?
Well, I think it's probably a little bit of both, to be honest. And then also you look at the velocity of money within the United States, it's extremely low. And so there's not as many dollars getting exported abroad. You know, the one thing that's helping is the price of oil is higher. And so, you know, to the extent that we buy oil, that more dollars is getting out to pay for that oil.
And our trade deficit, yeah.
But yeah, I don't think you can point to any one thing and necessarily say this is why the dollar is getting stronger. I think the Fed talking about tapering, the expectations of a potential rate hike at some point, I think that plays into it. I think a lot of people think, raising rates is a bad thing for the dollar because it'll crash the dollar because we can't afford the interest payment. But yeah, in the long term, that's true. And it's true for kind of any country. But in the short term, it means that the global reserve currency, which you already have to hold anyway, and that has the fastest growing market, pays you more to hold dollars than it does to hold any of the competitors. So why wouldn't you hold dollars? So that draws capital in and it pushes the price higher.
I think
the other thing I would say, which we didn't touch on, one of the other reasons is, you know, Christine Lagarde, you know, the head of the ECB, and, you know, we talked about the dollar index is very heavily weighted to the euro. She's been extremely dovish the last couple of days. And it's, or the last couple weeks. I mean, she basically said, you know, inflation pressures are running rampant, but it would be a mistake to try to tampen those down now because we could throw ourselves back into recession. You know, so you hear someone say that, you know, that it sounds like they don't have too much concern for their currency. So, you know, the euros had a big sell off here just in the last couple weeks.
Yeah, I noticed there. I had this discussion with Andreas Steno Larsen. He's on FinTwit quite a bit.
Yeah.
And he's really neck deep into what's going on with Europe. And I didn't realize it, but they're seeing significant wage inflation there that they have not had in, 20 years or so? That's a good point, that because our stance with the Fed is maybe more hawkish, some might argue, and their stance is getting more dovish, then that could create this discrepancy. I think the big disconnect for most people is they see the prices of the stuff they buy going up so much, and they see all of the domestic inflation we've had, but then they see the dollar going up on the DXY, and it doesn't make sense. From a logical standpoint, it's counterintuitive.
And that is part of the reason I have gotten so much pushback on my whole thesis, is that people just can't understand how you can have a rising dollar and higher inflation or higher cost of living. And the point I've always made is that, you know, fiat currencies trade relative to each other, and all of the problems that people point out with the Fed, that it's trapped, that we have all this debt, that nobody wants to put their money in a store value that can be debased. It's all true. It's just that it's true everywhere else as well. It's true in Europe. It's true in China. It's true in Japan. And so you can get into the situation where the dollar rises versus everything else, but falls versus real goods. And so there you get gold and dollar rising together versus everything else. So, you know, it's not going to be a straight line, and it doesn't necessarily have to even begin right now, but I just don't see it playing out any other way.
Yeah. Now, a lot of people know you just from your view of the dollar going up on the DXY, but they forget that your business is really managing stock portfolios. And we had this discussion as well. So I'd really like to get your view on the stock market, maybe more specific sectors that you're bullish on right now.
Yeah, I mean, that is a big myth. I think there's this big perception out there that, you know, I'm this dollar bull. All I talk about is the dollar. And so therefore, I'm just sitting on cash waiting for the, you know, the sky to fall. And, you know, we own equities that we have literally owned for 15 years and have never sold them, right? So, you know, we have no intention of selling them either. I mean, we think that it's probably overdue, and I've said this for a while, we're probably overdue for a correction in equities. And I think it would actually be healthy if we had one. But ultimately, I think equities are going a lot higher in the years ahead. And some of the sectors I think that will go even higher, despite the already extremely lofty elevations, are technology. I think technology will probably go a lot higher. I think commodity-based, specifically agricultural-based equities will do really well. I mean, we already own a number of these equities. Like, we've owned Pioneer Foods. We own John Deere. We own Mosaic. You know, companies like this they've done really well. And, you know, I think they'll continue to do really well. It doesn't mean that there won't be some periods of time where it's absolutely terrifying to hold on to them. Right? But I just think that in the years ahead, you know, I think all currencies are going to get debased. Not at the same rate. I think the dollar will be the last one to fall. But ultimately, I think as a currency crisis develops and it you know, becomes a sovereign debt crisis, when money leaves debt, I think one of the last places it will go is U.S. equities. And I think, you know, the big blue chip dividend paying equities, agricultural based, you know, and technological based equities will do really well in the years ahead.
Yeah. One thing I love about dividend paying stocks is that thesis doesn't even need to play out in order for the investment to pan out, because it's right. Paying you to own it. I wrote down a couple other misconceptions that I wanted to review. Just get your thoughts on it, like 30 seconds, then we'll dive into some questions. And we talked about the dollar cash flow outside of the United States. And, you know, when we were talking about the rate of inflation inside the United States relative to the DXY, I always suggest people compartmentalize the dollar. Or you almost have to look at it as two separate currencies. You got to look at it as the dollar inside of the United States and the dollar outside of the United States, because the supply-demand equation is completely different. And I think that would help people really understand it better. But I think that also, too, that the dollar velocity outside of the United States is really impacted by these global governments instituting further, let's just call them restrictions, with the cerveza sickness. So we in the United States, if you live in Florida, Arizona, Texas, you say, wow, this is pretty open. It's kind of like living in 2019 if we weren't surrounded by all the other chaos and craziness. Yeah. But they forget that there's countries like Austria, as an example, that are going into complete lockdown again. Italy is considering this. You know, you've got Australia, what's happening there. And all of these lockdowns or restrictions are creating less dollar velocity and therefore less dollar denominated cash flow to service that debt. Yeah. Do you have any views on that?
No, it's absolutely right. And it's, you know, there's several times over the last 10 years, I've given a presentation where I kind of walk through the basic mechanics based on the design of the monetary system. And I always put up a chart that has a plus sign and a circulatory kind of a velocity sign. Mm. And I always say, these are the two, if you don't remember anything else from the presentation, just remember these two signs, because it all comes down to this. And that because of the type of monetary system we have, where money is loaned into existence, you have to have velocity of money. It has to circulate. If it doesn't circulate, the debt doesn't get paid and you have defaults.
So Brent, if it doesn't circulate, then what is the option for that corporation with the dollar denominated debt? Because that goes into my next question here.
Well, if money is not circulating and a company does not pay its debt, then it defaults on its debt and then its borrowing costs increase. They would have to get an infusion of capital somewhere, whether they have to go out and raise new capital by issuing stock or bond, or maybe the government has to give them a bailout. But somehow, there has to be a cash infusion into the system. And that's the plus sign that I always talk about. And this is where the Fed, if there is no velocity, the Fed has to come in and re-collateralize the system by putting new base money into the system. This is exactly why a year ago, when they shut down the entire global economy, just said, told everybody, go home, shut your doors, and don't go outside. No planes, no trains, no automobiles. They stopped the circulation of money everywhere. It just stopped. Well, that is why they had to go in and provide so much supply. That is why they had to go in and do QE on a massive scale, not just in the United States, all over the world. They had to do these capital injections. It's because there was no velocity. And so to your point now, when velocity stops, when people have to go home, when they have to stay home, and, you know, in countries where it's largely a cash economy, and where, you know, literally the dollar bill is traveling from person to person to person, it just kills the velocity. The problem is that in countries outside the United States, they do not have a Fed that can come in and recollateralize the system. They have to get money from their central bank, and the only place their central bank can get it from is from the Fed via a swap line. So velocity is really key to my whole thesis. It should be the key to everybody's thesis, because without velocity, the entire system crashes. There was a guy several years ago that wrote a report, and he said the monetary system, I can't remember his name off the top of my head, said the monetary system is like a shark. A shark has to keep swimming. A shark can never stop swimming. If a shark stops swimming, he just sinks to the bottom of the ocean. And that's the monetary system. You know, if we don't have velocity, we're going to have a dead shark on our hands. You know, who wants a dead shark?
And I also like to point out the balance sheet of the bank that's on the other end of that default. Because then their balance sheet capacity to issue more dollar denominated credit or loans in the future decreases.
You get supply constraint, and in some cases a contraction in the credit available. And when you get a contraction of the credit, supply is getting contracted. So now you've got a situation where even if demand for dollars is falling because those loans have defaulted, supply is constricting, perhaps even faster than demand, and price still rises. I mean, that's think about it. In a credit crisis or in a credit crunch, the price of money does not fall. The price of money goes up because there's not as much of it, right?
Yeah, and then also, too, I'd like to point out that if they do have cash on their balance sheet, their local currency, then let's just take a step back prior to the default. The other option they'd have is to sell those Colombian pesos, let's say. And if they're selling those pesos, and that creates more supply of pesos, more demand for dollars. And that's where you see the dollar really crush that local currency.
Yeah.
I think this is what we've seen playing out in Turkey. Am I correct?
I was just going to say, Turkey is a perfect example of this. And I always hold Turkey up as an example, not because they're the only ones who are guilty of it and it's the only one who's going to happen to. I think it's going to happen to several countries, most countries around the world. But it's specifically bad in Turkey for a couple of reasons. Number one, they have an economy that is not growing very fast and is actually, you know, struggling. So their top line is not growing, or at least not growing very much. They also have very little of their own energy. So they have to import 90% of their gas and oil. 90%. Mm-hmm. Now, guess what gas and oil to import that? Guess what you have to pay? Guess what currency you have to use to buy gas and oil?
Dollars.
Okay. So their top line is falling. Their bottom line expenses are rising. So they're getting squeezed in the middle. And their currency, they have to keep printing their currency.
Yeah.
Right. In order to exchange for dollars to go buy the energy. And so that makes the currency fall. Well, then right now, Erdogan, the president of Turkey, he is pushing they're having high levels of inflation because they're having to print a lot of a lot of lira, right? But he doesn't want to raise interest rates to combat the inflation because he wants to lower interest rates in order to juice the economy. So we've got a situation where the monetary authority in Turkey has to make a decision. Do I lower rates to support asset prices, or do I raise rates to fight inflation? And it's playing out right now in Turkey, but it is going to play out everywhere. The U.S. is dealing with the same thing.
Yeah,
do we taper QE to fight off, you know, inflationary pressures?
Yeah.
Because Manchin, the most powerful senator in the world right now, doesn't want to sign off on these budget deals because of inflationary pressures. Or do we say screw the people? They're going to have inflation, but we need to keep doing stimulus in order to set. To support asset prices. Same thing in Europe. Christine Lagarde, which we just talked about, she knows there's inflationary pressures, but she doesn't want to counteract them because it could cause asset prices to fall. Same thing in China. China has incredible deflationary pressures due to their real estate market contracting. And they have huge inflationary pressures because they import their food and they import their energy as well. So what do? Do they import, do they cut rates in order to help Evergrande and the other real estate markets and then exacerbate inflation? Or do they try to control inflation and then exacerbate the real estate crash? And it's everybody, the last 18 months, people don't realize that you really kind of have to give a little bit of the credit to the central bankers and monetary authorities, because they have walked this tightrope, this razor's edge, about as well as possible. Now I think they're going to fall off one side or the other. And I'm not certain which side they're going to fall to, but I don't think they're going to be able to walk this razor's edge for the next 18 months the way they've walked it for the last 18 months. And so again, all countries are kind of in the same bucket right now. Do we support asset prices or do we combat inflation? And it's not an easy answer.
This podcast is brought to you by Rebel Capitalist Pro, the best online investing research. I have teamed up with Chris McIntosh and Lynn Alden, two of the best in the business, to create Rebel Capitalist Pro and give you the tools you need to build wealth and thrive in this crazy world of economic insanity. Rebel Capitalist Pro is jam-packed with Chris and Lynn's incredible research. We have live stream Q&As where you can ask your questions directly to Chris, Lynn, and myself. And the best of all, there's an online member forum which allows you to network, learn, and explore ideas with like-minded individuals. What are you waiting for? Check out Rebel Capitalist Pro right now at georgegammon.com/pro. That's georgegammon.com/pro. Take action today and do something your future self will thank you for.
I think so. Looking at that dollar outside of the United States, if we want to look at those two separate currencies or look at the dollar that way, you see that gaining value. But at the same time, all currencies, including the dollar in their domestic economy, are losing value relative to goods and services.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's absolutely right. That is literally my, and I think that will continue. And that's literally my thesis.
Yeah. I think people always assume that your thesis, because it's dollar positive on the DXY, mm-hmm. assumes that that's deflationary in the United States, meaning that the price of food is going to go down.
Yeah, though. So this is probably the biggest misconception about how I think this all ends, is that everybody thinks that I'm this big deflationist. And that's fine. I think there was going to be periods of long along the way of just, you know, teeth chattering deflationary shocks. But ultimately, the thesis is an inflationary thesis.
Yeah,
because
right.
What I believe is going to happen is all fiat currencies going to be debased. Asset prices will rise in the United States versus the dollar. But the dollar will rise versus all other currencies. And you get into the situation where you have equities going higher, you have rates going higher, you have gold going higher, and you have the dollar going higher against, and everything else is falling.
Yeah. So, and I would argue, even if stocks are going up or housing is going up, they might just be going up in nominal terms.
Yeah.
And for inflation, they might be going down.
Yeah. Yeah. And again, this isn't going to be a straight line. Again, I think there will be just terrifying moments along the way. You know, December of 2018 or October and December of 2008 were kind of terrifying. March of 2020 was kind of terrifying. You know, I have no illusions, despite the fact that I think equities are going a lot higher. I have no illusions that there's not going to be similar periods like that, you know, along the way. I think they're going to be short lived, but they're going to happen.
Yeah, I think asset price is far more volatile. I think consumer prices just kind of stick to that.
Yeah,
that trend up. I don't think they'll be as volatile. True. Yeah.
Unless the deflationary shock gets away from the monetary authorities. Like if people say, you know, food and consumer prices never go down. Well, if they had not gotten a hold of the market in March of 2020, consumer prices would have fallen. Real estate prices would have fallen. Food prices would, because everything, it would have been in the Great Depression, right? And in the Great Depression, prices absolutely fell. Now, I don't think they're going to stand aside and let that happen. They're not going to try to let it happen. But just because they don't want it to happen doesn't mean it can't happen. I don't think it's going to happen, but I'm not going to sit here and say it can't happen.
I think that gets really complex because then if let's say they did another lockdown. Yeah. We're talking about the demand side of the equation with the amount of dollars, but the supply side, you know, you can have the amount of dollars decreasing, but if the supply side goes down even faster, then you could still see those prices increase.
Yeah.
It's just most people get fixated on the demand side. And I always like to encourage people to think of the supply side of that equation as well.
Yeah. And you know, the thing that you and I were talking about this a little bit, and I was talking to somebody else about it as well. It's like, I really, really think everybody seems to be kind of in their camps. I'm a deflationist. I'm an inflationist. Gold's going to 10,000. Gold's going to zero. Bitcoin's going to be the new savior. Bitcoin's a scam. Like, and I talked to so many people who are just absolutely certain. Like, I would encourage everybody, whatever your view is, try to argue the other side and learn the other, learn the arguments against you better than the people who argue against you. So that if you had to argue their point of view, be able to argue it better than they can. And that's really the only way that I think is going to be able to get through this, because, you know, I obviously have some pretty strong opinions and nobody's been able to so far convince me otherwise. But I'm always willing to learn. And I feel like I could argue the other side of my case very effectively if I had to do so.
I think that's really the sign of an educated view or an educated opinion, that you can argue the other side just as well.
And so if you don't, like I said, if you don't know the arguments for deflation, go learn them. If you're a deflationist and don't understand how it's possible we could have inflation, go learn it. I mean, it's not going to be a waste of time. You know, you might not change your mind, but it's not going to be a waste of time.
And it'll sharpen your views as well. It'll make your arguments far better if you understand the other view. And because, you know, I'm doing that in my whiteboards all the time. I'm trying to almost prove a point through like this jury trial, where I'm giving these charts and these facts to kind of back up this thought experiment. Yeah. And, you know, I'm trying to think, what would the rebuttal to this be? What would the rebuttal to this be? And then trying to give data to prove that point further. And
The one thing I would say, one thing, because I do get a lot of people that ask me, how is it possible that inflation won't continue? One thing I would say is, if you're looking for the arguments for how inflation might not continue, for inflation to really reign, you need an increase in the money supply, right? Or you need access to money to increase. The banks are currently not lending, right? They did it massively a year ago because they were guaranteed. And so via PPP, the government guaranteed these loans and everybody got these checks and through the stimulus plans, you know, cash was put into bank accounts. That is stimulus. That is stimulative, and that creates a lot. And not only does it increase the money supply, but at least for a moment, it increases velocity. It's like throwing a big rock in a still pond, right? Throwing that much new supply in is going to cause some ripples. But if you just do it once and you just sit there and you don't do it again, those ripples will eventually stop, right? And the velocity will die. So then you either need to throw more money in or you need to get the velocity up. Now, so far, velocity is not increasing. We were just talking about how it's not, you know, they're continuing the shutdowns in some cases. So new supply for inflation to continue at the same rate that we've seen. Now, it doesn't mean we're going to have deflation. It doesn't mean the prices are going to crash back down. But to assume that prices are going to continue to rise at the same rate that they have, you have to have another supply shock. An increase in supply. And if it's not coming from lending, then it has to come from the fiscal, right? And I don't remember exactly what
$5, but not necessarily. Yeah, so I would argue, but it's also supply goods and services, because we saw velocity go down significantly in 2020.
Right.
We saw the price increase, but that was due to that supply side of the equation we were talking about earlier.
That's right. So if you don't get new supply from lending, then you're going to have to get new supply from fiscal. And right now, they're having a hard time passing the proposed budgets. And the proposed budgets are a lot smaller than they were last year. Right?
I just want to be very clear, Brent. You're talking about supply of dollars. You're not talking about supply of goods and services.
That's correct. So again, it doesn't mean that I'm right. It doesn't mean that's going to happen. I'm just pointing out, you know, those are the types of things you need to kind of think through. How could your thesis possibly be wrong?
Yeah. Let's take a couple callers. Let's see if we've got some questions here. Is that Josh? Oh, here we go. Sir, what is your name?
Oh, hey, George. My name's Jesse.
Hey, Jesse. Thanks for calling in. You got Brent Johnson on the line.
Awesome. How's it going, Brent? I actually met both of you guys over at the Rebel Capitalist event down in Miami.
Oh, cool.
You look familiar. And,
I talked to both of you guys and Brent, man. Honestly, your presentation down there completely, I mean, while I was like at the end of your presentation, I was sitting there and I was kind of just going through my portfolio afterwards. And I just was really like, it caused me to really focus in on a lot of holes that I definitely had. I was, you know, pretty heavy in the inflationary camp. But you really helped me kind of see things in like a different perspective. And, you know, since then I made some changes and they've been very positive. So it, I sleep a little bit better at night too, you know? So I was a little bit too heavy in that. Yeah. Thank you. I was a little too heavy in some volatile assets, but, my question, what I really wanted to ask you guys was, Brent in particular, do you have any concerns? Like, let's say that we transition over to a digital dollar system and, you know, the way I kind of picture it is that could potentially cause a significant panic amongst a lot of investors and just, you know, amongst people in general. And would you expect the dollar to retain value should that, you know, investors start to panic because they see that they potentially could get locked into this digital system, you know, with no way to kind of get out of it? Like, you know, who's to say that they won't put like, you know, any kind of restrictions on purchasing like decentralized assets like Bitcoin or gold or silver or anything like that? And do you think that potentially that could cause a dramatic decrease in the value of the US dollar opposed to like, you know, assets, decentralized assets?
Well, I think short answer is yes, it certainly could. Now, whether it will or not, I don't know. Some of the factors to consider would be, again, you know, the dollar may lose value versus assets, even if they don't change it to a digital currency, right? The question becomes, really in my mind, is if they change it to a digital currency, does it lose value versus other currencies? I would say, you know, versus gold, if you consider gold a currency, it very well could, but I don't think the US is going to roll out a digital currency in isolation. You know, I think China's going to roll one out. I think Japan's going to roll one out. I think Europe's going to roll one out. I think this is the new wave. I think this is what they're going to do. And so just because the U.S. does it doesn't mean it will necessarily be a bad thing. In many ways, the dollar's already digital, right? This is just a new type of digital. It allows them to focus at certain sectors or certain people, you know, to helicopter money more easily. It would allow them to put, you know, an expiration date on it or something. If you don't spend this money in the next 30 days, it goes proof or whatever. So, and I think in general, the reason they would like to have these types of currencies is so that they could debase it, right? I mean, you got to think, you got to put yourself in their shoes, right? They're not doing it just for the hell of it, right? They're not doing it for our good. Right. They might say they are, but they're not, right? So if they're rolling it out, there is probably some motive that benefits them and doesn't benefit us. And so to think that it couldn't happen, I think would be extremely naive. It's just a matter of, you know, what does it fall against? And, you know, it doesn't necessarily mean it falls against the euro or the yen or the pound or whatever it is.
Yeah. Right. Well,
go ahead. Yeah, I was just saying, just remember that this, just because we have the dollar fall against or go down, depreciate in value against goods and services, it can still appreciate in value against other currencies that are being debased at a faster rate due to those other central banks having digital currencies themselves.
Yeah.
Right. I think my biggest concern is just the fact that it's software essentially, so it can be programmed to do it. I mean, pretty much anything that they want, you know, very easily. And I mean, prior to really starting to study your work a lot more, Brent, I was just very heavy in like gold, silver, Bitcoin, a lot of other cryptos, just stuff that was outside of the system, just because that's been a significant concern. Just because, I mean, you know, me and my fiance, we both just got fired because we didn't get the vaccine. So it's kind of like, you know, we're just like, we don't want to get shut out of the system, essentially.
Yeah. And sorry to hear that, Jesse.
Yeah.
It's all good, man. You guys, honestly, people like you guys have helped us so much. It's why we're able to stay afloat and keep our heads up. So honestly, but yeah, the only thing that really scares us is just, you know, the potential of, like, let's say that, you know, they program it so if you don't get the vaccine, then you can't bank or you can't, you know, generate income or trade or do anything essentially. So that's kind of, what my major concern is.
These are all concerns that are very legitimate and should be taken into account.
Absolutely.
I wish it wasn't this way, but it is.
Yeah.
Right.
Jesse, in the sake of time, buddy, we're going to have to leave it there. I sincerely appreciate the call. It was a pleasure meeting you in Miami. Hopefully we'll see you in Houston. Yeah, we'll take one more.
Okay.
Okay. Caller, are you there?
Hi, George.
Hey, what's your name?
Hi, my name's Brian. I'm from Cincinnati, Ohio.
Awesome, Brian. Well, welcome to the Rebel Capitalist, I guess, show or offshoot of it. You're on with Brent Johnson.
Hey, Brent.
Hey.
Good. My question was, I was just thinking, is there an example of a fiat currency going into hyperinflation where the country actually had access to fissile nuclear material?
To what?
Had access to what?
Nuclear material, nuclear weapons or nuclear power. Because I'm assuming that any country that currently has access to nuclear technology, their currency can never be worth zero because they have access to it.
Question. I actually don't know the answer to it. The only thing I would say is I don't know when Israel attained nuclear capabilities, but they went into hyperinflation, I think, in the mid to late 70s, early 80s.
I didn't know that.
And whether or not they had nuclear capabilities at that time or not, I do not know.
Yeah.
But is your argument that they would use their military force to, you know,
get
services rather than just printing for it?
Not necessarily that, but the fact that they still have assets. So, you know, nuclear material itself is an asset. So, like when the Soviet Union collapsed in the 80s, they were able to sell us plutonium and some of their stuff for our use. And the Soviet system is still here. The Russia is still here. So they're still a player in the space race and all this other stuff. So just that when a country achieves a certain level at that level, it's not possible for their currency to actually ever go to zero. Like, George, one of your examples on your videos is like Weimar Germany. That happened before, you know, nuclear technology was available to multiple countries.
And look at Venezuela, though. They don't have nuclear, but they've got a massive oil reserve. So that would be a huge, huge, huge asset. Yet you still see hyperinflation there. So I still think it would be possible, unless I'm not understanding your line of thinking, to have a massive asset like oil or some sort of nuclear reactor or something like that, and still see hyperinflation.
Yeah, I think one of the things that you're getting at, I don't think you're completely off base, because if you have assets that you can sell to foreigners, then there is some demand for your currency, right? Or for you to trade with that country. Where countries that go through hyperinflation, they go through hyperinflation because they don't have any goods or assets to trade, or few assets to trade, and there is zero demand for their currency outside their home country. So when they start printing, the reason they go into the high levels of inflation versus other countries is all of that printing is just staying within their domestic borders, and it's not leaking out. And nobody buys that currency or buys that debt because nobody needs that currency or needs that debt. And that's why you will often see hyperinflation, or just, first of all, hyperinflation gets used way too often, but just,
yeah, right.
high levels of inflation typically happen in peripheral countries because they typically don't have the assets or the demand for their currency outside their borders.
Yeah.
Okay.
All right, Brian. Well, that was a great question. I'd never really thought about that. So thank you for bringing that to our attention.
Sure. Thanks, guys.
Bye-bye.
All right, Brent. Well, that was a lot of fun, man. I enjoyed it. Yeah. Thanks for coming on.
We'll have to do this more often.
Absolutely. For the viewers who want to find out more about what you do, where can they go?
Go to SantiagoCapital.com. You have my contact information on there. You know, I'm very active on Twitter. You can type Santiago Capital into a search bar. My handle is Santiago AU Fund. And you can also go to YouTube or Google and type in Brent Johnson, Santiago Capital, and you'll probably get a number of links that should highlight presentations and interviews. And, you know, obviously check out Rebel Capitalist because that's I'm here quite often as well.
Yeah. And I also want to point out that, you know, in your managed accounts, you're not only just sitting on a large pile of dollars, but you're actually deploying those dollars. So you have a massive amount of expertise in equities and other things that you're not as well known for.
That's right. That's right. I appreciate you saying that, and I appreciate you giving me a few minutes to kind of clarify what it is I do.
Yeah. All right, man. Have a good one.
All right. Thanks a lot, George. See ya.